KALW.
I think it's just a misperception, but also a correct perception that if you live in the United States, you have more money.
Today, when you're the one in your family who made it, sometimes there's an expectation to share your wealth and help relatives.
I may be thousands of miles away, but I'm still expected to do certain things. It all goes back to this idea, this very Kenyan thing called Harambe.
Black communities call it the black tax. Whether you're African American or a black immigrant, it's that feeling of obligation that comes with prosperity.
But then I also think those of us who live in the United States feel like sometimes we're taken advantage of.
Today, an episode from the Stoop podcast. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Hey, what's up, Leela?
Hey, Hannah.
You have WhatsApp, right?
Yeah, I use it all the time. It's so much better than texting. And, you know, a free way to call people internationally. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge all over the world. But Leela, when you're using WhatsApp and you're connected to like 40 or 50 people in a single group chat, sometimes a lot can be expected of you.
How so?
Let's stoop this out.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
Stories from across the Black diaspora
that we need to talk about.
My cousins were water and grease girls, and I couldn't be a water and grease girl.
That's what I'm talking about, ballerina in the hood.
We be Gullah Geechee United people.
When a black woman walks up to the desk in labor, what preconceived notions do you have about her?
I didn't even know we had a hair chart.
The Stoop.
WhatsApp is used to chat with people. You can share photos and videos. It's huge. It has 2 billion users worldwide. So what is complicated about it for you?
I mean, I use it all the time to stay in touch with family all over the world and in Sudan. Like, if someone's born, you know immediately. If someone gets sick, if someone dies, you know, like, right away. And knowing means that there's something you need to do.
So last summer, I wake up one morning, check my WhatsApp like normal, but see some terrible family news.
That's Mwende Inohosa.
She's Kenyan-American. She lives in Berkeley, California. And one day, she gets some news on WhatsApp.
My tata is sick and in the hospital. It takes 24/7 care from my auntie, Mama Mwangi, to care for my 98-year-old grandfather. Plus, ongoing financial support from the whole family. He's in the hospital suffering from pneumonia. He's also diabetic. And those few days in the hospital left the family with a very expensive bill. I've been in close contact with my family in Kenya since 2014, and it's all because of an app, WhatsApp. After my Mwaitu, my grandmother, died in 2014, my cousins in Kenya decided we should keep our bond strong by staying better connected. Mwaitu, which means our one, was the rock of the family and made sure our unity was strong. Being together is what our Mwaitu would have wanted. So we used the space to joke around, share memes, tease each other, and brag. It's also a space where the monthly cousin meetup is organized. My family is deeply religious, so that monthly meeting is a space to pray for one another, sing praise songs, and fellowship. But back to my tata and his hospital bill. After the news, my Uncle Max uploads a blurry photo of the hospital bill to the family WhatsApp group. It's a very long list of all the medications and services. I'm talking IV drip, insulin, radiology, all that stuff that Tata had while in the hospital, totaling roughly $400 American. And Uncle Max shared the bill for a very specific reason, so we can all pitch in. And it's not even a question. I have to give. That's what we do.
So here's one thing about Mwende.
I'm the only cousin born and raised in the U.S. You can spot me from a mile away in all the family pictures. In a sea of dark mocha skin, I'm a pop of tawny brown with a big fro. Because I have a white American dad. My mom came out here for college, met my dad through her uni friends, and they got married, and then boom, I was born.
She doesn't speak Swahili or their tribal language, Kikamba.
I'm locked out of the jokes, the songs, and the worldview that comes with speaking with your mother tongue. I've mourned an essential part of myself I will never understand. But mostly, I keep in touch thanks to technology. Back in the early 90s, calling my Mwaitu and Tata in Kenya was a major event. It required pre-planning, you had to make sure you bought the correct phone card, and it was loaded with enough money. You needed perfect timing. Everyone had to be near the correct phone line at the correct time. And then, of course, you needed luck. Because sometimes the connection, it just didn't work. When we did connect, the delay, the echo was so bad. It took a few minutes just to get through the pleasantries. I would yell into the phone, "Hello, Mwaitu! I love you, Mwaitu!" And then a long pause, and then hear her giggle and say to me, "Wacha," which is a greeting an elder gives to a child. I had no patience for this. So I didn't really have a genuine relationship with my grandparents and my extended Kenyan family until cell phones were cheap and everywhere.
That takes me back. Wende yelling into the phone to her Tata and Mwaitu is exactly what we used to do when we were kids in Houston and my parents would call Sudan. The folks in Sudan, they'd actually dress up and travel to the person's house who had a phone. It was a hassle, you know? It was just a big deal until cell phones came along.
And you know what? Kenya uses smartphones more than anywhere else on the continent. More than you guys too, Hana. Mwende, why do you think that is?
M-Pesa.
What's that?
M-Pesa is a cornerstone app for all Kenyans. The M stands for mobile, and pesa means money in Swahili. So you send money to another person through your phone like a text message. You don't need a bank account, and it's currently one of the most successful mobile money systems in the world. M-Pesa started back in 2007. Venmo didn't even start till 2009.
Visit your nearest M-Pesa agent today. Terms and conditions apply.
I remember going to Sudan on vacations and just being amazed that they could send money through their phones so easily. It just wasn't a thing at that time here in the U.S.
I mean, and Nairobi is a tech hub.
Yeah, folks call it the Silicon Savannah. It has a billion-dollar tech industry. It's a place of innovation.
M-Pesa came out of a necessity to hustle. Kenyans pride themselves in being entrepreneurial, especially Nairobians, those people who live in the capital city. My cousins would just say everyone has to be a hustler to survive. Even grannies out in the shags is slang for countryside. Even those grannies have cell phones. They send their coffee beans to market and get paid via mobile.
So Mwende, that's M-Pesa. What about WhatsApp? How common is WhatsApp in Kenya and what do folks use it for?
88% of Kenyans use WhatsApp. WhatsApp is your texting system, your nightly news service, your public safety announcements, and your most reliable source of entertainment. It's basically everything. My two most active groups on WhatsApp? One with my cousins and one with my whole entire extended family. I actually had to put my notifications on mute because when I'm sleeping out here in the US, the Kenyans are chatting up a storm, making so many damn pinging sounds, I just had to shut it all down. I check the groups religiously though, but sometimes I do miss things. Like when my cousin Dunda had a baby boy and I was late on congratulating him. I felt guilty about that. So I try hard to participate in family unity as much as I can. So last summer, I deliberated with my husband on how much we should contribute to my grandfather's hospital bill. So I send in my $100 contribution towards paying Tata's hospital bill and pray he recovers. My mom is next to post this message in the chat.
Family,
Tata left the hospital on June 11, and Mama Mwangi had to borrow money to pay the above bill, 40,530 shillings. There was a call for people to help. These are the contributions so far. Donda, 2,000, Max, 3,000, Mwende and Mateo, 20,000, Mama Mwangi, 5,000, for a total of 30,000. There is still 10,530 remaining. Is there anyone else willing to give anything, anything at all, no matter how small? Anyone? By the way, Tata is home, but is still very sick.
It takes a few more days to raise all the money from smaller donations. But as a family, we do it. We pay off the bill. Or so I thought.
Okay, so Lila, let's pause here for a minute to talk about something very real. The amount of money immigrants send back to their home countries. Remittances. It's a lot of money. In 2019, Nigeria received $23 million in these remittances.
And Hannah, in some cases, remittances can actually be a huge part of the country's economy. In Haiti, for instance, remittances made up more than a third of the country's GDP.
But Lila, going back to Mwende, here's the thing. She's not an immigrant. She was born and raised here. But like, she still feels that obligation to help her extended family in Kenya, and it's because she's connected to them. For her, it all goes back to that WhatsApp.
I'm fascinated by how WhatsApp affects family dynamics. Now that the diaspora can stay connected to the motherland, we're better connected. But then there are things that come with that closeness. Cultural obligations and expectations. I may be thousands of miles away, but I'm still expected to do certain things. And one of the most confusing expectations for me is this kind of fundraising. It all goes back to this idea, this very Kenyan thing called Harambe. It's actually the official motto of Kenya.
We have this thing in Kenya where what we call Harambe. And that is the spirit of coming together to do something, the spirit of unity.
That's my mom, Christine Mativo.
And that spirit of unity has done a lot, you know, each person contributing just a little. Neighborhoods built schools, neighborhoods built churches, because everybody contributes what they can. And that's what I really wanted in the family.
She loves to support her loved ones. She's a dietitian, and she lives in California's San Joaquin Valley. But she was born and raised in Kenya and immigrated to the U.S. in the late 70s and has been here ever since. One Sunday afternoon, before the coronavirus hit, I was dropping her off at the train station, and I asked her this question that was kind of nagging at me. What happened to Tata's hospital bill last summer? It fell short. So how was the rest of the money really raised?
Eventually, I just contributed the rest, which might be wrong. I felt maybe it was expected because he's my dad and I live in the United States. So I decided to make sure, you know, I'll just take care of it. And I don't want people to feel like it's a burden for them. So I just do it.
I thought the family had come together to pay Tata's bill, but my mom just ended up paying it off herself.
Where do you think the expectation came from that because you live in the U.S., you have to contribute more?
I think it's just a misperception, but also a correct perception that if you live in the United States, you have more money. It is true. I think it's true. But then I also think those of us who live in the United States feel like sometimes we're taken advantage of. They have never been to the United States and see how hard we work for the money we make. They just think money grows on trees. A lot of my Kenyan friends, their family relationships are ruined because they feel their family thinks of them only in terms of money.
That last thought stayed with me. I don't want the basis for my relationship with my family in Kenya to be money. But I gotta acknowledge the weird power dynamic being in the diaspora creates. Anyone in the diaspora knows the feeling of going back to the motherland and being treated like a VIP. It always makes me feel uncomfortable. Are they genuinely happy to see me? Or excited that I might take them out and buy them things? Is it wrong for me to even question their intentions? I need answers. And there's one cousin I go to who will always keep it 100 with me. My cousin, Makuthi. I want to hash this out with him.
Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by, like, after you came and visited and you saw the way that I live my life, that your expectations changed? Can you just explain a little bit more, like, what you mean by that?
Yeah, it is. So the Kenyan mindset of the first world countries is that the money has more value and it's a lot easier to make lots of money. That's the Kenyan mindset or perception, regarding the first world. But having made a visit a couple of times, I know very well that also the cost of living is extremely high and everything is expensive.
Ha! Yep. I live in the Bay Area. It feels like the epicenter of all things expensive. In 2019, the average one-bedroom apartment in Oakland, $2,839.
That grocery store, right, that I think I went to that grocery store a couple of times in my job. The one near your house, I forget what it's called.
Berkeley Bowl.
And I remember one morning we went to buy salted salmon and bread. And I remember that bread, I don't know if it was like normal American bread or what it was, but I remember that bread was $7. I will never forget that. $7 is 700 shillings here. 700 shillings can buy me, I think, 15 loaves of bread here. I remember that like it was yesterday.
Makuthi has visited me here in the States several times over the past 10 years. He's seen how I live. I'm not balling like the Kardashians, which in Kenya is the perception of how all Americans live. Makuthi saw all the homeless encampments, gentrification, and segregation. He was shocked. And so now he kind of gets my perspective. But I have this other cousin, Blessings Mutheu. She's never been here. She's 12 years younger than me. And I want a young person's perspective on this. Someone who isn't expected to pitch into the family fundraiser yet. What does she think of all of this?
When I saw that bill, personally, I was like, oh man, I need to contribute because I'm an adult, I have a job, and not only that, I'm in the US. So dollars make more of an impact in Kenya.
So technically, from what we know, people in the US have money. So you should be having money. We are here suffering in Africa. We're in Africa, we're suffering. So you should send more money. But I'd attribute some of it to how we've grown up, what we've been taught, or what we've seen as we are growing up. And our willingness not to change that. Because we can change that mindset. It's just a mindset that we have.
Can you be specific? Like, what do you mean?
Like, say white privilege. Like, you know, you might probably not be as white there, but when you come here, you really stand out. And people treat you differently. Yeah? People treat you in a special way.
And there it is, my white privilege. My dad is a white American. If you have any kind of white ancestry, you're a Mzungu, a white person, a foreigner, privileged, rich. This is something I've thought about a lot, but it's oddly refreshing to hear Mutheu say out loud, I have white privilege in Kenya. My cousin Makuthi likes to tease me and call me colonizer, but no one has ever been this straight up with me before. She's totally right. Being the child of a white father has given me so many advantages. I have an American passport, access to generational wealth, wealth accumulated through centuries of colonization, and fluency in white culture. This helps when I need to find a job or housing.
yeah, it's like you said, I have white privilege, I have Mzungu privilege, I have American privilege. In that sense, it's like, you know, it, like, why did God make me born over here and everybody else over there? I'm feeling a sense of, I don't know, responsibility in a lot of ways. So I'm torn. I'm often torn. Like, how much should I? Because I always contribute.
I think from my end, I'm just sorry and apologizing. But, you know, because technically we put that pressure on you, whether we say it or we don't. How we look at you, how we address you, how we view you. Yeah, we sort of contribute to that pressure. I wish I could tell you there was one solution to it, but I don't know. I feel like these are those things that, you know, they're always going to be there. Just need to find a way around it. Maybe find, I don't know, maybe be more comfortable with what you can and not what we think. So yeah, as long as your family is fine, you're not sleeping hungry, make a, you know, wise choice on how much you want to contribute. And if you're okay with that, then anyone else, that's their problem.
Eh, Mudo, I did not know you were this wise.
I am what? Yeah, you underestimate me.
Wow, 22. You just taught me many things.
Mudo was right. I just gotta be comfortable with what I can do and leave it at that. Why is it that the most simple things are the hardest to do? Just as I was wrapping up this story, my tata died. I was told he'd finished his regular evening fellowship and prayers with my auntie Mama Mwangi and her family. He had asked to have a glass of water before bed, and when they came back to give it to him, they just watched him quickly fade away. He was 98. He lived a long, full, joyous life. I'll miss him, and he will be missed. We buried him at the beginning of May on our family farm right next to my Mwaitu. I was told over 100 family members came to say goodbye to Tata, wearing masks and standing 6 feet apart from each other. I'm thousands of miles away, but I was right there with them. It made me realize this technology that at times seems so intrusive and kind of annoying, it helped me be part of one of the family's most important moments. And I'm grateful for that.
Leela, I bet a lot of folks could relate to her story. People who have family in other countries, you know, somehow you feel a responsibility to support them.
Yeah, and it's not just in other countries. We feel it in this country too. You know, Black families helping each other out, and there's this concept, and it's called the Black tax. And it's this idea of a duty that we feel we have to give back to our family and to support them.
The Black tax. I'm glad you brought it up, because I want you to watch something with me.
What are we watching?
The Sharks are back for an epic 10th season.
Shark Tank.
Next in the tank is a more sophisticated version of a traditional snack.
So you know Shark Tank, the hit show on ABC, where entrepreneurs come and they try to get a panel of millionaires to invest in their businesses. In this episode, a Black woman came on.
Hi, Sharks. My name is Keisha Jeremy, and my company is Sanaya Applesauce.
Okay, so Keisha, she starts her pitch, trying to convince them to invest in her company. Then a bit later on, this issue comes up that she also has a day job, a corporate job, in addition to this business she's asking money for. So one shark, Mr. Wonderful, we all know him. He's, you know, famously just like mean and abrasive. Well, Mr. Wonderful, he calls her out on that because he wants her to quit the day job and be all in.
Why aren't you throwing everything into this?
I cannot afford to.
And then Keisha, she just starts to tear up. And one of the sharks just looks at her. And then there's this intense exchange.
So why are you tearing up? Tell me. Is there like, why are you tearing up?
I take care of so many people financially. This is the first thing I've ever done for myself. And I would never squander the commitments that I have to family members if I didn't believe in it.
Who is it that relies on you?
My mom, my dad, my siblings. I'm the person who made it.
Ugh. I know this is hard to watch. Look at them all quiet. This is intense.
Yeah, it was really awkward. Now, Lila, they did end up investing in her company, but I was like, can we all just have a moment and listen to Keisha?
This is real. I mean, so many families of color, they rely on at least one person who has made it, like Keisha said. And that can make it hard to save and hard to invest and hard to start a business.
It's not a new struggle.
No, and it's tied to a history of disproportionate distribution of wealth in this country.
Even recently, in 2016, the net worth of a typical white family was $171,000. A black family's net worth at the same time was a little over $17,000. That's 10 times more, and that's in 2016.
Wow. And yeah, without all that generational wealth being handed down, black people have had to support each other.
So we wanted to talk to someone about this black tax, someone who feels it and someone who's also trying to find a way to make it easier for folks.
My name is Thomas K.R. Stovall, and I am what people refer to as a process architect.
What's a process architect, though?
So he's a longtime black entrepreneur, and he helps other entrepreneurs. He helps them plan out, like, to design their businesses around the realities in their lives. He's like a life architect.
It is, to a degree, traumatic for people to carry the weight of literally entire families and communities on their shoulders.
Thomas knows firsthand how tough it is when you've got family you need to support.
I think we all deal with it in the black community. Most of us, we've got a cousin, we've got a brother, somebody. For me, I've got a brother who is, you know, has always struggled with being in the street. We're on two totally different paths. He's older than me by a decade. And I had to, at a young age, be someone who bailed him out of jail and, you know, deal with him not being appreciative and always asking for more and more. And you feel really guilty, especially when you don't know whether or not you're going to one day get that call. That's like, hey, this thing happened to your family. And that's always in the background when you've got a family member who's struggling.
Thomas says for him, it was this feeling that came from deep inside of him.
I happen to grow up in a middle-class black family. My dad is an entrepreneur. He has an insurance brokerage. My mom was a teacher for 40 years. And they both grew up in Arkansas in small towns picking cotton, literally. So I stand on really, really broad shoulders. I've always felt like it was my responsibility one day to take care of mom and dad. They've not asked me for that. And my friends and other extended family haven't asked me directly for things like that. But as you start to get more success, you definitely see where people start making hints at things, you know, around the holidays and things that would be really nice to get. And can you make an introduction here and there? And I don't mind those things. I had a real estate investment business that I grew to seven figures in about 18 months from $3,000 of my savings at 27. And I found myself finally in a position to be able to take care of friends and family.
And yeah, I mean, it is a good feeling. I mean, it does feel like it's ingrained in us and black people that you just take care of your family. So when you actually have the means to be able to do that, I mean, that is a very good feeling.
But what if you start to have financial trouble? I mean, life happens. And for Thomas, there was this time when things took a turn.
4 years later, I found myself starting over. Now, I started over at 30 and was no longer that person who could provide opportunities or could pay for a dinner for one friend It was, for me, humiliating and humbling, of course. For me and my peers who look like me, especially in the technology world, sometimes you don't get a second shot. Maybe you really had one shot and one window of time to go and build this thing. And if it doesn't work out, mom, dad, aunties, cousins, they don't have any money to invest in you. And if they did and they gave it to you, you feel really bad about having lost it. There's a different level of responsibility we feel. And failure is a little bit tougher to rebound from.
And Leela, those feelings, they can take a toll on a person.
You got one time to get it right. And so it's called the upside down friends and family funnel. When, you know, when white people, for example, they go to friends, family, colleagues to raise, well, it's different in the black community, because a lot of times you have those same friends, family, colleagues who cannot help you, but their hands are out asking you for money. So when you make that first six figures, it's not really six figures, because you're paying for a nephew or a niece or a little cousin or a little brother to get their first opportunity to go to school or to have a new set of gym shoes.
The upside down friends and family funnel. Girl.
Mm-hmm. There's a name for it.
Oh my gosh, and I love that name. And so what solutions does Tomas have for all this? What is a black professional to do?
I've gotten to a point now where I say, you know what? I think the most important thing we can do is collectively take a step back, get your survival taken care of before you try to give any and everything to everyone else. Put your oxygen mask on first.
And Leela, I mean, that's the thing. It's hard because there's some guilt, like Wendy was talking about earlier. Then at the same time, I have to ask myself, where does it end? And I definitely have to put on my oxygen mask and create some limits, even if folks may talk about it. It's hard.
I hear you. I mean, it's like sometimes it can break us down financially. Then other times, it's
that one tax that we feel so proud about paying.
That's The Stoop. Special thanks to Mwende Inohosa, who shared her story with us. Thanks to our sound designer, Seth Samuel. Music by Daoud Anthony, episode art by Nima Iyer.
Support for The Stoop comes from California Humanities. Thank you, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Find them at calhum.org. Special thanks to the NPR Story Lab.
Ooh, and don't you forget, we have another interview podcast called Stoop Talks, where Hannah and I just sit down and we chat with some names that you might know, like LeVar Burton, David Oyelowo, Stacey Abrams, Franklin Leonard, Uzo Aduba, and more.
Yes. So you can hear Stoop Talks. Just subscribe on Luminary and let us know what you think. All right. Until next time. Bye.
Masalama. Did I say it right?
Yeah, you did.